my pleasure to be designated the chairman of this group on the legislative side by the coordinator, possibly because I have a long association in the territory and the state with the legislative branch, and somehow have never managed to run for public office. I'm Jack Doyle, and I'm executive director of the Legislative Affairs Agency, now serving a sort of second tour of duty in the job. I've had a long fascination with the branch because when I first came to Alaska in 1952 at the behest of then Governor Greening, I was really shocked to find that our legislature, our territorial legislature, consisted really in between sessions of six large gray crates stored in the basement of the Capitol at Juneau. The then House chamber was used by a federal agency. The then Senate chamber was used for furniture storage, and the four little offices were used for expanding federal agencies, and they forgot us for another 22 months. It was a powerless legislature that met without any staff. Its biggest assets were two creaking mimeograph machines and some paper. It had no facilities for pre-organization. We were paid by the federal government. The law had a long list of don'ts and can'ts. And after 60 days, you closed up and went home. The then skeletal executive branch did its own merry thing, and we had no judiciary. And it certainly pointed out to me there was a crying need for something like statehood. I had, by a curious circumstance, written my master's thesis on the Alaska statehood movement, unencumbered by any presence in Alaska. I did it at the University of Texas, which is good neutral ground for that sort of thing. And with some great aid from Delegate Bartlett, Ernest Greening, even George Sundborg up here, who sent me some rather good propaganda for the statehood cause, I wrote a sort of a home rule thesis, a legislative and political history of the Alaska statehood movement, which is a home rule effort. And therefore, I found myself coming to Alaska very well informed, a little prejudiced, but very well informed, more so than a lot of residents, and with an eagerness regarding the legislative branch. Working with Governor Greening, I could look downstairs and find that legislature had no library, had no regular staff. The largest library in any department in the territorial government, I remember, was about something 2.5 inches thick over there at the Department of Taxation. It was like going to the New Windsor Hotel in Cordova and finding their library while you're waiting overnight. There was a book on the keeping of bees and another one on the Alaska Yukon Exposition of 19 something or other. So I've had an early enthusiasm for the legislative branch, and I was able to recommend to Governor Greening that we go ahead with an idea of legislative council, which two members introduced, and the governor wanted to veto because he's mad at something else. But I was looking ahead to a job in the future, so I talked him into approving it. Well, we have here before us a distinguished group of Alaskans who've had experience in the legislative branch or a close observance of it. It really is a distinguished group, and I just wish we could have some of the delegate members in the audience here who have been both participants and observers in on this. I think it is a real rich crop of people who were concerned. The group we have here will be led off by Steve McCutcheon, who is, I guess, the elder statesman of the group, although looking younger, who was the chairman of the Committee on the Legislature at the Constitutional Convention. I told Steve the other day that I hope he hasn't changed his mind on some things, because at the staff level and in justifying things, we've quoted his statements to the convention over the years as gospel. This is how it was intended, this is what it was important, and if he didn't mention it, we knew it was an incidental matter not to be disputed. I've had hints since that he may have not mellowed on a few things but changed his mind, and I hope he doesn't mess up all my arguments over the years. Our plan this morning is to have presentations by each of our panelists and then take a stretch break, allowing them to return some interchange briefly among the panelists, and then throwing it open to the delegates, students, and guests here to ask questions and make succinct, the word is succinct, comment if need be, so that we can draw out some of the reactions and the wishes of the group in the audience as well as here at the table. It is now my pleasure to call upon Steve McCutcheon, who was the chairman of the Committee on the Legislature at the Alaska Constitutional Convention, to give us the background and the action taken by that committee, which will set the stage for the participation of the other members of the panel. Mr. McCutcheon.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. I think that probably our Constitutional Convention approached the matter of its legislative branch with a basis of fears in protecting the future citizens of Alaska. Our fears could only stem from what we had experienced. Some of these fears, I suspect, may have been overblown, but from what I have seen of the activity in our legislature, which our legislative branch set forth in this convention, has rather, in some sense, justified our caution. To go back a few years, let us say, from the acquisition of the territory of Alaska in 1867, for the first 20 years, there was virtually no government whatsoever, and then a sort of a semi-military or quasi-military control of the then territory. And we were governed in after 1887 by the old Organic Act, which applied to the territory of Oregon. It was a rather self-limiting document, which certainly little applied to Alaska. In 1913, after much furor in this pioneer country, the Congress saw fit to include us into the semi-state of the Union, let us say, by giving us a Bill of Don'ts, the Organic Act of 1913, which rather limited, and as Mr. Doyle has indicated already, rather limited the activities of a legislature then comprised of 8 senators and 16 representatives from 4 judicial districts, which the territory had been divided into for court purposes. Because of that limitation of personnel in the legislature, it was obvious that the effective industry, lobby, or pressure groups could be very potent, because it required only 1 or 2 votes to throw a whole house either into pandemonium or to block any kind of a bill. Somewhere along about 1935 or 36, I don't just recall exactly, Congress, after a census, declared that we were to double the size of the 2 houses. So then we had 16 senators and 24 representatives, which did help some in the elimination of lobby pressure, but certainly didn't eliminate it all. My father, who was in the legislature from about 29 to 45, indicated that it did relieve some of the lobby pressure, but he says it certainly didn't by all means. And I'm reminded of the story of one of the legislators. There was a very serious bill on the floor in those days. Most of our funds derived from taxes on fisheries. And the fishing lobby, of course, is very powerful. This gentleman sold out his little vote, which was the balance vote in the Senate, for, as my dad says, a case of whiskey, a suit of clothes, and a trip to Seattle for the winter. That was his lobbying fee. Well, I'm happy to say that there has not been much condemnation of our legislators for accepting fees aside. Well, I think Alaska has been relatively free of much in the way of gratuities, although there has been some business sorts of gratuities that took place. So when we came up to the Constitutional Convention, some of us who had been in politics and had some experience in politics for a number of years feared certain aspects of the creation of our legislature. So to begin with, we had the most serious thing I think facing us was which way should we go with our legislature? Should it be bicameral or should it be unicameral? Our legislative branch group committee met and decided that we should try and induce the convention as a whole to sit in as a committee of the whole and have general discussion, pro and con, on the matter of the advisability of adopting a unicameral legislature or a bicameral legislature. There were a good many arguments on both sides. Mr. McNeese over here carried the ball on the behalf of unicameralism and made a very admirable presentation. He had done a great deal of research on it and presented a lot of facets of American government I don't think that many of us were acquainted with. For instance, I hadn't known up till that time that there were some 8 or 9 other states had tried unicameralism, and I didn't realize that most of them had dropped that before 1900, going to bicameralism, with a sole exception being Nebraska. So in the course of our several hours of discussion, many people, I think, had open minds, and many people made that observation that they favored one or the other, but they were going to keep open their mind to see finally what part of an article that our group would bring out. It seemed to me, however, that the predominance of opinion was in favor of bicameralism, and that's the type of an article we worked on. However, in the course of doing our work, while we did adopt some rather radical principles, which you might say reflect unicameral thinking, and I'll touch upon those in a little bit. To go down through a few of the things that we did, which were quite some different in our legislative branch. There was considerable argument in our group to establish salaries. I felt strongly that the salaries should be left up to the legislature. Whether wrong or right is neither here nor there. Mr. Bebout said that yesterday in his remarks that it was remarkable of the minutiae that was left out of this Constitution, leaving it to be devised by the legislature. So that is why no salary or expenses were put in. Our sessions were not limited, although I think if I were personally doing this thing over again, I would put a limitation on the session. But at that time, the convention felt that there would be such a great deal of legal work necessary in the transition from territorialism to statehood that it would require some very lengthy sessions in order to provide the law background for the utilization of federal monies and also to establish titles and clear whatever things that would permit our business area and atmosphere to progress. So we left it open as to limitations. And the legislature has decided that they need ample time to consider their business today. Although I don't think that the problems that are presented to our legislature today are nearly as serious as they were in those first several years of meetings. One of the things that we needed to consider, and we did, because up until the time that Governor Greening came to Alaska, no governor had ever called a special session of the legislature. Perhaps there was no need for it. But it would seem that in some 30, 40 years, that there would be some kind of a thing that would require a special session. But no governor ever called one until Governor Greening appeared in the scene. So in order that we would not be limited in the necessities, if the necessity arose, to have a special session, and we had an obstinate governor who would not call it, we put in the proviso that the legislature could be self-starting, and it would be, the vote would be taken, tallied, and the members would be notified through the very committee that Mr. Doyle heads, so that there would be no way that the will of the people, if it was required, could be thwarted by either the legislature or the governor. So, in order to have a clear separation of power, and we did make clear separation of powers in this Constitution, we provided that in the event one house got mad at the other and they couldn't go home and they wouldn't quit, that if they'd certify to the governor could adjourn the legislature. But that's never been done, and I doubt if it ever will be done, but maybe it should be done sometime. One of the major departures that we from the normal bicameral type of organization such as our United States Congress, one of the major departures was in the line of vetoing. We felt that the governor should have the opportunity to line veto, line strike any appropriation. And here's where we departed into the area of unicameralism, is when we decided that in order to override a governor's veto, both houses had to meet in joint session. In joint session, on a veto of matters other than the fiscal, in the fiscal area, it would only take the standard 66 and two-thirds or 66% vote to override a veto. But in the matter of a fiscal area, in the fiscal area, it would be a matter of 75% in a unicameral situation, because we felt that there was a necessity to provide an adequate break on legislative action and manner of appropriations, so that the governor could hold to his budgets. On the other hand, why, if the matter was so popular that more than 75% of the legislature could see it was a matter of propriety to override the veto, then certainly it must be a public interest. So this was our main departure into the field of unicameralism. Another departure, which probably will never be used, I hope it will never be used, within the matter of impeachment. Normally, the impeachment proceedings are brought by the House and are tried in the Senate. We felt, some with trepidation, of course, that it might be better to reverse this, since normally the Senate is the older, more experienced body. If there was wrongdoing in any of the offices of the government, the Senate would be the most likely to be able to bring the charges. The House, being the most newly elected and the most newly responsive to the people, would be the place to try any impeachment proceeding. So this was another departure from the normal bicameral system of government. I think that we were very serious in thinking about how our state should be governed. And as I recall, there was so little partisanship ever shown in our Constitutional Convention that it was really astonishing to me, since we had some pretty rabid Democrats on one side and some pretty rabid Republicans on the other. And yet partisanship never shown. And I think a great deal of it is reflected, that nonpartisanship is reflected in the document that we made.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCutcheon. You can see what I meant when I knew he was talking about it, and he hasn't really let me down yet in his support of the legislative article. Next, longtime friend of mine and a former Speaker of the House, Speaker during the 8th Legislature, and I think a veteran of 9 years in the legislature, Tom Fink of Anchorage. Tom, would you like to give your presentation?
I think the Constitution that we have, insofar as the legislature is concerned, has been excellent, and I think it has worked. I think in the big scheme, the legislature is to be composed of people who reasonably represent the views of all the people in the state. I think it substantially accomplishes that. The legislature is to make policy the way I understand it. The executive is to execute that policy. And the judicial is to settle disputes and determine if things are constitutional. I think the judiciary has gotten a little out of line, but I think the legislature substantially has been able to set policy. Seems to me, within the workings of the legislature, it's important that we have a group of people that have the time and the means to determine what the problem is and have adequate time to review and come up with a solution, and that a majority of both houses makes the final determination. And I think, essentially, that under this Constitution, we have that. There no doubt are some abuses, but by and large, if the majority of either house wishes to express itself and get a bill through or defeat a bill, it may do so under the terms of our Constitution. I think, in fact, it works that way. There are certainly have been occasions where the majority will, I think, has been thwarted, but it's only because the majority either was not sufficiently astute or didn't care to be recorded taking a strong position one way or another. I think there's a third area that, or another area that the Constitution is involved, and that is the relationship of the legislature to the executive. And I think essentially this does a good job there. I think that the executive has a little more power than I would like to see, but by and large, the legislature, if it cares to exercise its authority, can determine the policy of the state. And, of course, in the long run, I think the only way the legislature can exercise its authority is through the budget process. And very often the legislature doesn't hold together long enough to exercise that authority. Now, some areas that I think that we might consider some changes, although I don't see any overpowering need for any changes, but areas in which I think that the legislative section of the Constitution might be changed. I'm not totally satisfied with the reapportionment process. I don't know exactly what the right process is. I think our last reapportionment, we particularly feel in the Anchorage area, I don't think that the outcome was what was intended, that we get a good cross-section of representation. I think that there's room for change in the area of a person who's in the legislature taking an appointment after he gets out, the Warwick case and the Strandberg case. It just appears to me that if a legislator is active in creating a new job or raises the pay of a particular job, he ought to be barred from that. But it appears to me that he ought not to be barred from taking a job if there's been a general pay raise. That if change would be made, since the Supreme Court has ruled on it, it would take a change in the language of the law. It's no biggie, but I think that there have been times when people have been in the legislature would be available for appointments, and now they're going to be barred for a period of a year. And that 1 year period of time often will be the time that the man will decide to withdraw from government totally. Now, another area, and one that I think is probably more important of these that I'm going to review, is the length of the session. I have always in the past, or maybe the first half of my 9 years in the legislature, opposed any limitation on sessions. I felt that the members ought to be big boys and ought to be able to do things in a normal course and get in and get out. The 2 years that I was speaker, I think we had a 90-day session and a 95 or 96-day, which was sort of a throwback because the sessions had been getting longer, and that shortened and then it went back long again. And I think there are enough disadvantages to a long session, and primarily in the people it discourages from running for the legislature, that if I were to make one recommendation for a change in the Constitution, that would probably be it, to limit the session to something like 75 or 90 days, with the provision that both houses, by a vote of two-thirds or something, could extend the session another 30 days. Again, I think the system we presently have is working. I think this, however, would be a substantial improvement. Another area that there is some abuse, and the public thinks there's a terrible amount of abuse, is in the area of the Free Conference Committee. Sometimes there have been great abuses, not always. And again, if the members of the legislature wanted to see that there were not abuses, they had the power and authority to do that. But I think that a change in the area of requiring recorded votes on free conference committee reports, and maybe even requiring that the legislature can't take it up for 24 hours or so after it's been submitted to the legislature. It would slow things down. It would give a little more certainty that people would have an opportunity to find out what's in the free conference committee report. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. I suspect that the main reason it's necessary is because the public feels that they're being abused by the way the free conference committee reports are used. And so that I would think that the main benefit would be in the credibility of the legislature with the public. Now, another area, the area of vetoes, and Steve commented on the unicameral type method of overriding vetoes and the method of confirming gubernatorial appointments. There are certainly advantages in meeting jointly so that neither house could defeat an action or make it the basis of a majority or two-thirds or three-quarters of the entire 60 members. That, I think that has an advantage. But practically speaking, there has been some disadvantages in the necessity of meeting jointly. And that disadvantage is it has been difficult from time to time to get both houses to meet. One house wants to take up the issue, another house doesn't want to take up the issue. And it takes, both of them have to agree, or it just doesn't occur. The Constitution recites that the vetoes are to be taken up immediately after they occur. Well, that has been, of course, I guess, what does immediately mean? But in my mind, it's been vastly abused. We very often wait 2, 3, and 4 weeks, maybe, before a veto is taken up. And I think the method, particularly as used in this last session, of delaying the confirmation of the governor's appointments till near the end of sessions, I think is bad, a bad situation. I think that the legislature should take up confirmations very shortly after they're made. The person who is sitting in the job, waiting to be confirmed, really isn't doing the job the way he ought to be doing the job because he knows he can't cross too many legislators or he won't get it confirmed. I think that there is an abuse in that area. Whether it requires to go so far as a constitutional change or not, I don't know. But I think confirmations ought to be taken up immediately. And to say it immediately won't do it. I think having two different houses could very well do it. I know when I was Speaker that we were able to force the Senate to do certain things by our taking action, and I suspect they felt they were able to force us to do certain things by their taking an action. And I would think in most legislative sessions, for taking up veto messages or taking up confirmations, that one of the, either the Speaker or the President, one of the two of them, would want to get it, take it up and get it over with. And I think if they did, it would force the other House to move. So I'd be losing the advantage of two-thirds of 60 rather than two-thirds of 40 and two-thirds of 20. But I think that the action would be more prompt and I think be beneficial. Certainly not a biggie. In the area of the governor versus the legislature, you know, I look back and there are times when I felt that the governor didn't have enough authority, and there are times when I felt the governor had too much authority. And it really boils down to whether I agree with what the governor's doing or I disagree with what the governor's doing. We've had a good number of battles. Mike and I here would serve 9 years together. And we were constantly scheming on ways to get our will. And some of the issues the governor won, some he lost. The last few years have been more court cases. I think the one last year that the legislature lost was in the adding a whole series of new people required to be confirmed. The Supreme Court held that was part of the executive's authority, and we didn't have that right. And the court may well have been incorrect. I really, at this time, would not recommend any changes in the relationship of the governor to the legislature. Although, from time to time, I'm not satisfied. I don't know how to improve it without creating more ill than good. The area of the unicameral, I'm glad that Steve talked on the issue that it had been thoroughly reviewed. I can see some advantage in unicameralism somewhere down the road. But I think laws and constitutions do change, and I think at this time that change is not in order. I think if we have a problem in the legislative process, it's that we're passing too many laws. And I think if we have another problem, it's that we're not adequately reviewing the legislation which is before us. And I think that unicameralism would tend, it would not necessarily have to be that way, it depends on how it would be put into the Constitution, but would tend to speed up and I think cut back on the review of legislation. Jack, that ends my comments.
Thank you very much, Tom. Next, we have the alive and sitting Speaker of the House, Mike Bradner from Fairbanks, who will give his views on how the legislative article has been working for the state and for him, possibly.
Well, I think it would be hard to dispute, if you looked around the country, that Alaska has one of the most superior legislative structures. If you looked around the country, that Alaska has one of the most superior legislative structures. I always felt it was a useful thing to see some of our freshman legislators go to other states or go to conventions where there were other legislators present from other states. And they go to those conventions feeling that their legislature has to be a little backwater. After all, we're way up here in one corner of the United States, and certainly we can't be the innovator of the whole country. And they come back feeling that other states do have a lot of problems, and that they perhaps ought to protect their own system from going backwards, still while they find that perhaps there are some weak points in their own system that they can participate in correcting. But I think the universal feeling of people experiencing that situation is that they do have something to protect and be proud of. Partially, we inherited that structure from territorial days and also from several facets which were interjected in the Constitution. One was the very strong suggestion that what the legislature does between its two houses will have a uniform structure, meaning uniform rules, and that suggestion goes much farther than that, that many of our committee structures and so on will bear out that principle of uniformity. That, in a way, has created a situation where it's much easier for our houses to function together as compared to the other states where the two houses of the legislature embark in dramatic different directions, have different traditions, different rules, even different administrations, different research agencies. They are literally two different legislatures which must compete against each other. So for the legislative reformer, he often ends up disappointed coming to Juneau because he finds that we're about the most reformed legislature in the United States. I think our problems are the traditional problems that are faced in the bicameral system. And one of those problems, of course, is the aforementioned Free Conference Committee, which is an inherent part of the bicameral system. It is, in fact, added to the system to try to make the very confusing and inefficient bicameral system. I mean, it's cast in an inefficient structure. It's supposed to be inefficient. It's supposed to be a testing ground. And the Free Conference Committee was cast to try to resolve differences between those two structures. It brings with it its own evils. And we're somewhat stuck with the decision of the more we cure the Free Conference Committee system, you have to concede that you're contributing to the inefficiency then of the two bodies and the inefficiency of their resolving their disputes. I think in my dealing with the Free Conference Committee between the houses in the last 10 years would have to concede that it is often abused. Totally new items of legislation have a way of appearing in the Free Conference Committee between the houses and coming back to the floor, and since those reports are unamendable for some very good reasons, mainly having to do with the efficiency of the way the bodies operate, then the membership is somewhat stuck with having to swallow those new items. Now, I'd have to concede also, I think, in the past 10 years that philosophically, I have favored most of those items that have appeared in the Free Conference Committee. So I suppose it gets down in part to whose ox is being gored. But I think that we have to concede that the Free Conference Committee bears in its system all the objections which are generally registered against the unicameral system. Except you can do it in 60 seconds. Practically in the free conference committee system, it might take you 2 days in a unicameral system. Because in the practical standpoint, what happens in a free conference committee report, it's produced by 6 members, it's brought back to the body. They often, unfortunately, have very limited understanding of what's in that report. That can be cured. It can be cured, of course, by establishing time limits for those units. But again, that presumes that you are willing to slow down the legislative process, take more time. And of course, in the end, that abuts against the suggestion that we should put an overall time limit on the session. I'm not sure that you can have it both ways. If we're going to cure some of the abuses of the bicameral system, then it's going to make it a more inefficient structure, and I think that's going to beg the question of your time in handling legislation. The legislature also is often spoken of as being a singular unit. People tend to criticize the legislature as a lump sum unit. It is in fact 2 houses, it is in fact 18 committees and 60 different members with very independent ideas. I think there's one difference perhaps to the time in which the Constitution was structured though in the present day that's created differences in the legislature, and that's the gradual, I think, disintegration of party structures. 10 years, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, not only in Alaska but across the country, the party structure and the party discipline, and with that came also some undemocratic expression of power, I might add, tended to add an efficiency, however, to the bicameral process. And that's not there today. Now, I think a lot of people would agree with that. We're having legislators who are more willing to treat their ideas, their philosophy, their suggestions as individual items, and fight their own leadership, fight their own committees. They want them aired. But that in the process, the weakening of the party structure, while it's created something good, it's created an added inefficiency, which I'm not sure the framers of the Constitution could envision. That also begs the question of time and time limits on the session. I think we have to beg the question of the potential of a unicameral body down the line. Mr. Fink said, perhaps not in the immediate pressure at present, but perhaps down the road someplace. And the question, as more efficiency is considered in the legislative body, which, again, as the process speeds up or becomes more efficient, there is the danger of unfortunate enactments. That has to be balanced against the rising number of professional advocacy groups, environmental groups, public interest research groups, new kinds of media that brings the legislative process closer to the public, new ethics and government law, and a watchful press. And I would think as we gain confidence in those structures, then we may gain the confidence to make the legislative process a little more efficient. Looking at the problems that we do have that pertain to the Constitution, one is, I think, the size of one of our bodies that we run into in a practical effect. We have a 20-member Senate. Perhaps it's always because I have looked at it from the opposite end of the hall, from the House end, where we have 40 members. But I've always felt that a 20-member Senate was inefficient. It lent itself to personality cliques. It created significant problems as apportionment took place throughout the state. We now have senators that represent areas that are much larger than the size of Texas, where their personal contact with their constituents has, for all practical purposes, evaporated. We also have a situation in a 20-member body where you have a command of 11 votes. I think you become a little concerned when you can look at a social group and recognize that seven or eight members can be in that group, and you can be making decisions at a luncheon table. As you gain numbers in a body, you gain a more fluid kind of situation. Now, there's a top end on that, where I think a very, very large body becomes inefficient and has its own abuses. But I suspect in the end that we may have to consider a change in the Constitution that allows for expansion of the Senate and solving those problems of apportionment, and also solving some practical management problems the Senate has. It, after all, our uniformity rule mandates that it must have 9 committees. You can divide that into 20 members, and you can see that you have 20 senators racing between 4 to 5 committee assignments. This is a tremendous waste, because these are our most experienced members of the body. They have the best training, and yet we often lose their talents simply because the pace of activities that they're expected to keep up in multiple committee assignments. That's in stark contrast to the House, where Representative Greening, who's sitting at the end of the table here, had a singular assignment to the House Finance Committee. And almost every member of that committee usually has a singular assignment. That allows them to devote their full interest and their full time to developing a state budget. As a result, the budget is always developed in the House. The Senate budget, unfortunately, stands as almost a bargaining instrument. It's a shell document that is matched against the House budget for purely bargaining reasons in the Free Conference Committee. That has its roots in simply the composition of numbers that are in the Senate. I somewhat have a question with the 3/4 veto override provision for line item veto. I feel the governor perhaps should more often use the line item veto, but the legislature perhaps have a little easier crack at overriding that situation. Many of our problems in the legislature are also rooted in the legislature maturing and learning to use the powers it does have. It was just in the past few years that we began overriding executive orders of the legislature, that we really began dealing with appointments, holding confirmation hearings, and judiciously looking at the appointments. We have finally got down to the business of reviewing the regulations that the executive makes. We can override those regulations. We have rarely done it. And I would suggest, as we start doing it, you'll find the executive becomes much more sensitive as to what the real intent of the legislature was. There is one problem that Tom touched on that will need to be changed. Our legislature is a bicameral system and a unicameral system. We have many unicameral features. The consideration of appointments, overriding regulations, overriding executive orders are unicameral features. There is no provision to ensure that both houses will meet together. Now, if we have members of the House who are reluctant to attend that body, the body can compel their presence. This last session, President Croft and myself had a general agreement, just a gentleman's agreement, that if one House wished to meet with the other, that we would notify them if they disagreed, that they would give us back a date in which they would agree to meet. But I'll show you how serious that can be. We had executive order that was before us that had a statutory deadline on it. We were up against the 45-day deadline, and there was a question whether the Senate would meet with us. Because, in fact, on the vote on that matter, the House carried the number of votes to, in fact, defeat the executive order. The Senate was not for the action which was about to take place. They could have prevented that action from taking place by just refusing to meet. So I think this is a matter, it's a small matter, but at some point in the future will have to be taken care of if we're going to avoid problems. I don't have much more to say. I'm not sure at this time whether I'm a strong advocate of any immediate steps towards unicameralism, but I very much think it's something that people should consider as an option. again, matched against the growth of other kinds of advocacy groups and policing of the political system that they may feel is adequate to protect the body. In my experience as Speaker of the House, I found that it's very difficult to manage the flow of legislation between the two bicameral units. You can manage it within your own house. You can ensure that there is public notice. You can ensure that your committees give that proper notice and get witnesses in. You can even set out a flow and a timetable. But once the legislation reaches the opposite house, I'm afraid that the parties on each side tend to view the flow of legislation differently, and there is an instinct to not act too hastily on such legislation because they feel the other body has legislation which they're declining to act upon. And my feeling after 10 years in the body is that much of the length of the session is rooted in the natural aspects, I might say, the bicameral system, and of groups and people attempting to function together. That in part, I think, can be cured. We can do a better job of making the bicameral system more efficient, but it also begs the question of at least giving some intellectual consideration down the track to a unicameral system. Thank you.
Thank you, Speaker Bradner. Next, we will hear from a relatively junior member of the legislature, completing his first term and seeking a second, the able grandson of a distinguished grandfather, Representative Clark Greening from Anchorage.
Thank you, John, for a gracious introduction. Being a freshman, first termer, I felt that at least after the first session it would be somewhat presumptuous to make a lot of public pronouncements on how I thought the legislature might better function in terms of structure. But I think after a complete term, I think there's some general areas that I think merit the discussion. And I hear some talk about the unicameral courses will be on the ballot as an advisory issue. But I think the pervading issue today about the legislature involves the professional legislature. I mean, that's the way it's termed, I think. And I think this is maybe a false issue, but it's one which I think hides behind discussions of all lengths of sessions, how you length, you know, determine what is a proper length, what should a legislator be paid. I think all these questions deal with who do we want to serve? Who do we want to come from the body of the citizenry and say, we want to represent you? And I think the issue of those two, the salary and the sessions, deal with that. And I've come full circle. I started, I think, with the position that sessions, the Constitution probably correctly stated that there would be no limit, or at least left that question open to the legislature to determine. And but after seeing it in action, although I believe that the bicameral system does lend itself to longer sessions, I do believe a limit would be beneficial in terms of enabling a greater body of people to serve and to, in another aspect, allow issues, I think critical issues, to be decided in the end days of the legislature and more on the merits rather than who, than an endurance contest. And I think that's what it comes to. And I think really the people that we may term as professional politicians use the unlimited session, I think, to their advantage. In part because they have the experience, they know over a period of time that coalitions can change, structures of votes can change, and they can use that to their advantage. But in terms of understanding the legislation that's at issue, or the issue that's holding up the legislature, see, I agree with Mike Bradner, Speaker Bradner, that it's really the nature of the issue that involves sometimes lengthiness makes the length of the session or the debate divisive, but it's I think the fact that it's unlimited that will give a certain group of legislators who do not have anything to lose by an unlimited session the advantage, and that has nothing to do with the merits of the legislation. I mean, the legislation should stand or fall on its merits. There should be an adequate time to develop all the facts and have hearings. And it's hard to say what that time is, but I do think you should probably err on the side of allowing too much time, and certainly unlimited is going too far in that direction. But I think, say, 100 or 120 days at least sets a time limit in which people are working towards, and they're aware of what happens. I think what I've seen the last 2 years is that usually the final vote on the important issues is taken in the last days of the session anyway. But by setting a limit, I think you at least encourage people who otherwise wouldn't choose to run again or even choose to run in the legislature. In actuality, we already have a full-time legislature, or at least if it isn't full-time, it's more than a majority of your time. Even if you have a 90-day session, I think you still have pretty much the majority of your time taking up. It's a month getting set up. It's a month getting back to whatever you were doing after the session. And then in the interim, if you're not on an interim committee, and incidentally, interim committees really are beginning to do the bulk of the work, there's constituents and special interest groups that are calling you all the time. And if I don't care what your profession is, doctor, lawyer, engineer, when you get a call at your office, you don't say, "I'm sorry, this is on my nickel this time. You'll have to call back after hours or some other time." You take the problem and you handle it. And so in fact, we do have a pretty much a full-time legislature. I think the issue of pay is important too on who serves. I think pay ought to be adequate to encourage people from all walks, not people that necessarily live off, let's say, investment income or income that is not tied to their being at a specific place. And that is also related to the length of the session. So I think they go hand in hand. Adequate pay, despite the fact that maybe you only have a session limited to 90 or 100 days, and a limited session, so you work towards it. Now, at least 35 states have constitutional limits. Some of them, I think, were a little bit unreasonable in light of changing circumstances. I think that the 60-day limit that Delegate Sundborg was advocating may be a little bit short in terms of the budget that we have to deal with. I can see the budget getting larger, unbelievably, but it still takes a basic amount of time to understand it, and I think that even with staff, that 60 might be a little bit short together with some of the other issues that you have to deal with. But I do think a limit ought to be considered, and I think it will be next session. I came around full circle on that, and I think maybe some other people might reach a different conclusion. I've heard it argued that the limit on the session would work to the benefit of special interests that want to kill good legislation. I think good legislation makes it in the final days on its merits, ultimately. And I don't think the time limit would impinge on that. Nobody's really come down hard in favor of unicameralism, and I'd like to make a pitch for it. I do think the principal argument for it is accountability, and that was made by Delegate McNeese, and I think it's the most telling argument. There's a lot of the argument on the other side that I hear most frequently discussed is that you have a lot more legislation necessarily, or a lot of ill-considered or quick legislation, or just a lot more activity in the unicameral legislature. I don't think that's necessarily true. You build into the constitutional amendment, which establishes those safeguards to allow adequate time. That I think if you're going to want to have a deliberation process, that a bicameral system isn't necessarily the tool. In other words, if you're saying that you want it to be considered over a certain length of time rather than quickly, that's kind of an inadequate tool to say that you're going to set up two bodies to do it. I think you write that minimum time consideration into the Constitution. If that's the main goal of bicameralism, if the main goal of bicameralism is checks and balances, then somebody's misunderstood the doctrine. The doctrine applies between separate branches of government and not within, as I understand it anyway, within one branch. We have the strongest executive, one of the strongest executive systems in the 50 states, and
I think, to, if you believe in the doctrine of balance of powers, you should have an equally effective legislature in its own role, not necessarily a role that it invades on the executive, but within its own role, it ought to be able to be effective. And I think the unicameral system could give that legislature that ability to be effective. The accountability aspect means that your vote, of course, I think along with this too, you have to have every vote counted. And the problem of the free conference, of course, is eliminated with unicameral. And we don't have the question of the mysterious bills that are cloaked in the guise of being amendments as being adopted. You would have, I think, eliminated that by eliminating the free conference. There are other ways you can do that, but I think that the chief argument for unicameral is accountability. There's no buck passing between the houses. You can't say the Senate would have passed this good bill or if the House had, you know, acted on it. I think, and it also works both ways, coming to the argument of how a bicameral system prevents bad legislation. You can have it the other way, where the House promotes a bill that's very popular, and the final days of the session, it becomes only trading stock. In other words, if everyone, you see, I've seen anyway, and the bills go across, and then they sit on the other side. They sit those final days, then they're swapped. Now, there really isn't that second line of consideration that everyone thinks the bicameral system gives. It becomes just horse trading stock, and the final days, everyone trades real fast, and out it goes. So in many ways, the bicameral system could promote bad legislation and less consideration. That's something to think about. And what bothers me is I think there hasn't been enough discussion of the issue, so that even the advisory vote is likely to fail. And people don't realize that I think we need to go into it much deeper than it's being discussed now, and decide whether that issue of accountability is important. And whether, if nothing else, it might turn people around to thinking about ways that we could at least amend the bicameral system. One of them, I think, requires legislative action rather than constitutional, and that has to do with the yeas and nays on final passage shall be entered in the journal. Now, there's been a judicial interpretation, and there's been interpretations by various speakers of House that doesn't mean that free conference reports have to have a recorded vote. And I know this last legislature and other legislatures haven't been unique in passing some substantial legislation through free conference. It's a very useful tool in terms of dealing with smaller numbers of people, you're dealing with people who are up on the issue, but it has its drawbacks, and then they become a super legislature, and bills that have no resemblance to the two that merged in the free conference come out as final versions with no vote. And although the law as it now stands, if you take the judicial interpretations, is that this doesn't require a voice vote, I think the spirit of the Constitution is that it does. And that, I think, is something that we should address. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greening. Our final panelist before our break is a member of the Working Press who has been honored with an editorial title, but he has to still be the member of the Working Press, an observer of governmental activities, and, of course, has observed the Alaska legislature in action. He'll give us his comments. Fred Pratt of the Fairbanks News Monitor.
Thank you. Mr. McCutcheon struck a nerve in his introduction when he said that the people in the convention acted from a basis of fears of what could happen in government. I think my profession acts from a basis of fears in the same way. To me, I think more than some of the other people on this panel, and especially more to an attorney like Clark, laws are a very abstract thing, and it's somewhat of a shock to go down to the legislature and see a bunch of guys that are actually there writing laws, because laws are always something you just looked up in a book or asked a lawyer about. If you look at the legislature's business, they're to adopt and amend laws, and as a journalist watches this, generally we don't get too excited, certainly don't get as excited about, as a lot of people, about the laws that they adopt or amend, but we do generally tend to worry a great deal about changes in the rules by which the laws work. and take a lot harder look at changes in something like this. I'm touching on some of the issues that we've hit here. I don't think anyone dislikes a long stay in Juneau more than I do, and certainly reporters who spend as much time or more than the average legislator during a session will dislike a long session as much as anyone, but I rather think we would dislike more a system of limits. I'm no stranger to deadlines. I have a deadline in about half an hour. But while my profession is sometimes called literature in a hurry, I would hate to see government operate as justice in a hurry or legislation in a hurry. I'd hate to see that meet one deadline a year and then have to go into a special action in order to amend that. It's on the unicameral legislature. I enjoy discussing that topic because in discussing unicameralism, generally we get out a lot of problems that the legislature has, and we bear them on the table a lot more freely than we do in normal situations. When unicameralism was being discussed before the House Judiciary Committee,